Let's open our Bibles, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 10. Election day is 2 weeks from Tuesday. Get out and vote early and often. I'm actually quite excited to get this thing over with. I don't know about the rest of you, but the robocalls and the TV ads will cease. The signs will be removed from yards. And hopefully we can get on with loving and living instead of campaigning and complaining. Whatever happens, and whoever wins, please be gracious. Don't let the results divide you from your neighbors, and certainly don't let it cause a rift within this body. I know that this election is more serious than a football game, but in some ways, we sort of have to treat it that way. I will always want Michigan State to beat Michigan. Okay, now let me finish. But if Michigan wins, I'm going to love Pastor Rob and still be his friend, all right? Just want to be clear. Just want to be clear about this. Now, if you're attempting to be an informed voter, you've probably looked at the names on the ballot at some point and you've considered their platform. Their platform is what they stand for. And what if God was on the ballot? I think his motto would be, love me and love others as yourself. For details, read the Ten Commandments. Or maybe abundant life for all. Or you are way more blessed than you know. Or maybe way more blessed than you deserve. Something like that. Here's the thing. I don't think God would win a popular election. 3,000 years ago, he was kind of on the ballot, you might say, for his own people, and they voted for somebody else. Remember, they wanted a king like all the other nations. They wanted someone to judge them and fight their battles. Samuel had warned them that a king would come at a price. That is, they might get what they wanted, but it was going to cost them quite dearly. And they said, no, it doesn't matter. We will have a king over us. And God said that this was a rejection of himself. But he allowed them to have what they wanted. But God began arranging the circumstances, and Samuel cooperated with God. And one day, while Saul was looking for his father's lost donkeys, he ended up meeting Samuel, who informed Saul that he would be the next king of Israel. Samuel anointed Saul with oil, which was the symbol of approval, the symbol of blessing and affirmation. And more importantly, it was the symbol of the Holy Spirit that would come upon Saul in time. Saul then received three signs or affirmations. We talked about those last week, that this was to impress him with the realities that God would provide for him, and God would care for him, and God would empower him to do what needed to be done as a king. And the Spirit did come upon Saul and gave him capacity and ability to do what needed to be done. Then, what had been done in private needed to be done in public so that everybody would know who God had selected. Now we're going to read what happened at this public acknowledgement of God's choice, starting in 1 Samuel chapter 10 and verse number 17. Then Samuel called the people together to the Lord at Mizpah and said to the children of Israel, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt and delivered you from the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of all the kingdoms and from those who oppressed you. But you have today rejected your God. Himself saved you from all your adversities and your tribulations. And you have said to him, 'No, set a king over us.' Now therefore present yourselves before the Lord by your tribes and by your clans." And when Samuel had caused all the tribes of Israel to come near, the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. when he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was chosen. And Saul, the son of Kish, was chosen. But when they sought him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired of the Lord further, "Has the man come here yet?" And the Lord answered, "There he is, hidden among the equipment." So they ran and brought him from there, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any of the people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him who the Lord has chosen? That there is no one like him among all the people." So all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king." Then Samuel explained to the people the behavior of royalty and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Lord. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. And Saul also went home to Gibeah, and valiant men went with him, whose hearts God had touched. But some rebels said, "How can this man save us?" So they despised him and brought him no presents, but he held his peace. So the first thing that happened in this part of the chapter is a clear reminder. Samuel had gathered everybody together at Mizpah. And from chapter 7, we remember that Mizpah was the place they had gathered for prayer at an earlier time. Prayer that resulted in thunder that threw the Philistines into panic and gave Israel a great victory. They regathered at Mizpah after that victory, and they set up a large stone that they named Ebenezer, which means the Lord has helped us. Samuel then called them back to that same spot now at this particular occasion, at this place of remembrance. You know, it's good to have some places of remembrance. I want to remind you of something, or maybe tell you something that many of you do not know. But when you pull in the parking lot out here, and there's those three crosses, I don't know if you've ever noticed, but around those three crosses are piles of stones. And I imagine a lot of you don't know why those stones are there, but I want to tell you. When this property was first cleared out here for this building, there were so many rocks in this field, even the construction people said, we got a problem. And so somebody came up with the idea that when we had our groundbreaking out here, we would all go around, all of us who were a part of that move, would all go around and pick up a rock. And that was our way of clearing the property. But we had a purpose behind it. When we did our groundbreaking, we were all going to take a rock, and any grievance or any hardship or any unforgiveness or anything that we had been harboring as a church family for past years or months or whatever, we were going to take it and put it at the foot of the cross. And so if you, any of you that were here, remember that, it was quite a solemn moment. We walked all over this property, we picked up a rock, and whatever it was that we had, we were going to try to come out here in 2008 and have a clean start. And we took those rocks and we put them at the foot of the cross, and they're still there. I think about that every time we drive by that place. It was important for us to have these stones of remembrance. Well, this was the place that Samuel invited the people to. Ebenezer, here the Lord has helped us. And then he reminded them of what the Lord had said. The Lord said, "First of all, I brought you up out of Egypt, and I delivered you from the Egyptians." Now, that was a pretty big deal. You know, the Exodus, getting a million or so people out of a land to relocate. The plagues, the Red Sea, the cloud, the manna. God did that. God did all of that. Then God said, "And I delivered you from all the other kingdoms and those who oppressed you. Jericho, the giants. From Dan to Beersheba, all those kingdoms." And that statement by God covers those stories in Numbers all the way through Judges to their present time. That was hundreds of years, by the way. I think sometimes we forget how much time has actually passed in these situations. But they had already been a nation in the land for almost 400 years by this point. Think about that. God, for 400 years, longer than our country has really been a nation, God had cared for them, watched over them, protected them, and been faithful to them. Then in verse 19, the third thing God said was this, "But you have rejected God himself, who saved you from all adversity and tribulation, and you have said to him, 'No, set a king over us. So you might say they had an election and God lost. They didn't want him. Now here's the really weird part in this story. God would then help them identify the human king they wanted, and he would bless the king for the sake of his people. Think about that. God would give them what they wanted and then bless that king for the sake of his people. Instead of demanding a recount, God accepted the will of the people and he blessed them. So much for God only having one plan. It looks like God can continue to work even under less than ideal circumstances. Now, this was a sovereign choice. And the next thing you note here in the text is the way the selection took place. It's as if God said, well, this isn't the best choice you're making, but if you're going to do it, let me help you. Sometimes we act as if we have to get everything worked out perfectly in our lives before God will help us. Can I just tell you, God is so good and God is so gracious. He has helped us through many less than perfect situations. Amen? I mean, aren't you glad that you didn't, like, if there was only one set of train tracks and you had to stay on them from the time you got saved until this present day, and you had to get everything right in order for God to bless you and help you and keep you, that wouldn't go so well. We've all wandered a bit here and there, and God just keeps, he's with us. And he was with them. That's no excuse, of course, to be disobedient and to say, oh, well, God's just going to bless me no matter what. But it is a reminder that we haven't got things just as they should have been. He's still with us and still wants to help us. So Samuel said, present yourselves before the Lord by tribes and by clans. Now, if you heard last week's message, you might be thinking, wait a minute, the choice had already been made. Why do this again? Why go through all that rigmarole when God had already said, here's the guy? Well, I think there are a couple of reasons. Number one, so all the people would know that this was God's choice and not Samuel's. Samuel didn't want to be accused of having made this selection, and I think that this was a God's grace towards Samuel. Second, so there wouldn't be division among the tribes. In other words, there was no election. Sometimes elections cause division. Maybe you hadn't noticed that, but, you know, just think. God just said, this is going to be the guy. There'd be no division among the tribes that way. And third, so Saul would have another affirmation of God's leading. Think of all the things that God had done to this particular point to say to Saul, you're the guy, you're the guy, you're the guy, you're the guy, you're the guy. And now here again, in a very public forum, you're the guy. Interestingly, the people cooperated. Even if they didn't want God as their king, they were willing to let him appoint the one they longed for. The methodology is not directly mentioned. It was most likely the Urim and the Thummim. Are you familiar with the Urim and the Thummim? Well, if you read the Old Testament, you'll find that within the breastplate or the ephod of the high priest, there was the Urim and the Thummim. And it was a means of discerning the Lord's direction. When the high priest had to make a decision, they would pull out the Urim and the Thummim. It wasn't like one of those crazy eight balls that you shake like that and it gives you the answer. But there was some way, some device of some sort, not a mechanical device, but something that would seem random to somebody else that was driven or directed by God. Sometimes it's referred to as the casting of the lots. If you ever watch a football game and they do a coin toss, that's a casting of the lots. You know, the guy does this and lets it fall on the ground, heads or tails. That's the casting of the lots. And I've watched quite a bit of football and I've seen quite a few coin tosses. I've never seen anybody say, can we do 2 out of 3? You know, whether it's heads or tails, that's what it is. And so this was some kind of a methodology like that. This was the way that choices were made among God's people in those days by God's design. The whole land had been divided by lot, all right, from Joshua's day. We see it numerous times in the Word when it comes to the selection of people. Solomon wrote in Proverbs chapter 16, verse 33, the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. And in chapter 18, verse 18, casting lots causes contentions to cease and keeps the mighty apart. Well, you even know that if you have kids and you got two kids arguing about something and you flip a coin, that's it. That's over. That's the end. Now, the kid might say, can we do 2 out of 3? Still, it causes contentions to cease when there's some random thing, so it seems, in this particular way. So verse 20 says the tribe of Benjamin was chosen. That eliminated, 12ths of the group. Then the family of Matri was chosen. Then the family of Kish. And then Saul. Now you'd think that Saul would be nearby. But when he was chosen, he could not be found. It's kind of hard to imagine, really. But verse 22 says that they had to pray. They had to seek the Lord. They went to the Lord and said, so where's the guy you just selected? And they prayed. And the king they did not want, capital K, needed to tell them where their new king was hiding. There's just some irony in all of this. And the Lord said, there he is, hidden among the equipment, or some of your translations have, hidden among the baggage. Now, as you can imagine, there's plenty of speculation regarding why Saul was hiding. And Matthew Henry, writer of hundreds of years ago, he suggested 4 options. I'm going to mention them for you, and you see what you think. We're not going to vote. We're going to flip a coin. But first, perhaps he was hiding because he was conscious of his unfitness for such a heavy burden. In other words, as he thought about what God was asking him to do, he's just like, I don't think I can handle that. There's sort of a sense of humility in that. It was a big job. Second, perhaps he didn't want to be subjected to the criticism or envy that would result from other people. It's true. You put yourself in a public position, criticism comes, envy comes, it goes with the territory. And so maybe you could say it was a little bit of fear of man. Third, it's possible that he knew God was granting people second best and he didn't want to be part of it. You think about that. I mean, if you're a bit of an idealist and you say, no, I want God's will more than anything, and the people say, no, well, we don't want God's will. We want a king. And then God says, all right, I'll give you a king, and here's your guy. If you had any sense of idealism, it would seem a bit wonky to you. Number 4, perhaps he knew how bad things were in Israel and that he'd be sailing into a storm. I mean, donkeys in agriculture, be a king of a country that's surrounded by Ammonites and Philistines. I don't need this. Remember, he came from a well-to-do family, a family of influence. He already had everything he needed. I mean, he didn't need this. And maybe that was it. Now, of course, many scholars jump ahead to Saul's eventual failures. And they say, see, here it is, evidence of the unwillingness to do God's will was there from the very start. I don't know about that. Other people, both in the Bible and out of the Bible, struggled with God's appointment for many reasons. Moses, remember Moses? Lord, I can't do that. Gideon, needed to do that whole fleece thing twice. Jeremiah, the prophet. I remember after my ordination, I cried off and on for 3 days. I still cry sometimes. The pastoral staff went to a conference in Muskegon at Maranatha Conference Center Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday this past week. And there was a guy there named Brian. He was actually a senior high camper at Lincoln Lake the first year that I preached out there, like 30 years ago, for camp. Now he's a pastor, and then I felt really old. But he said to me, he said, Mark, he said, don't you just love what we do? He's like, I just love it. And I went, no, not every day. Come on. And I felt really guilty, but I was just being honest with him. He's like, you don't love it every day? I said, no. No, I don't. I don't love it every day. There's lots of things about your work probably you don't love every single day. So I don't know why Saul was hiding among the baggage. I do think it's a bit unfair to look ahead and judge Saul's actions here based on where he ended up. I mean, he did show up. He did show up. Instead of saying, give me three steps, mister, give me three steps, you know, I mean, you don't know that song, but it's good that you don't know that song. But he didn't say, God, you know, I'm leaving. He showed up. Then you have this presentation, and finally they get the guy to come up there, and when he stood there, he was taller than everybody. A head taller than everybody. And he was handsome. And he was from an influential family. And even Samuel said, look at who God has chosen for you. There is nobody like him among all the people. Saul truly had everything he needed to succeed as the forerunner of the Davidic dynasty. He had God's appointment. He had confirmation by signs. He had Samuel's blessing. Then he had public affirmation. And then Samuel explained to the people the behavior of the king, and he wrote it all in a book. And he laid it up before the Lord. That means he put it in some prominent location, maybe there at Mizpah, the place of God's help, the reminder of God's help. He said in this book, very likely, the things that he had said before about the king's going to tax you and the king's going to take your family and the king's going to bring you to submission and you're going to have to provide for the kingdom now and provide people and taxes. And very likely, he reiterated what was said in Deuteronomy 17 about what the king was supposed to do and about what the king was not supposed to do. They were getting all their documents in order, you might say. They were getting their constitution settled. They were getting the guidelines of the kingdom nailed down. This new government that had come from God was now on record. This made it clear that even the king was under the law. I wonder how many of you are familiar with a guy named Samuel Rutherford. Samuel Rutherford wrote in 1644, Lex Rex, not Rex Lex. What that means is that the law is king, not king is law. Now that's a very important distinction. Because if the king is the law, then he gets to do whatever he wants to. But if the law is king, then even the king has to come under the law. And what's being said here is the law of God, even though I'm giving you a king, the law of God is still king, you might say. And I would just say to all of us this morning, there are absolutes. There are objective absolutes, and even leaders are subject to them. Any leader who believes he or she is the absolute has forgotten the source of all things. The lawgiver and the ruler of the universe is the final word on all matters. We don't like that in this culture. I mean, in this culture, we want to have the final matter. We want to have the final say. And I won't go off into all the applications of that. I think you're smart enough to figure that out. But it is Lex Rex, not Rex Lex. And we don't get to be the lawgiver. We don't get to be the king. We bring ourselves under the king of the universe. Now, there was a mixed reaction to all of this. According to verse 24, most people were happy. And they shouted, "Long live the king! Long live the king!" And after the book of rules had been explained, Samuel sent all the people home. It's almost like, there, we have a king, now all is well. I mean, can't you just see this happening? It's like, this has been settled now, we have our king, everything is going to be fine. They probably thought this simplified their life, but their lives were actually about to get quite complicated. In verse 26, it says that even Saul went home. He went back to Gibeah. However, not everybody went home. Some men whose hearts God had touched went with Saul. I read the thoughts of one scholar this week that suggested that they only went with him for socioeconomic reasons. In other words, they wanted to stay on the good side of the king now, you know, sort of suck up to him, if you will, for their own profit and their own influence. We're so quick to judge other people's motives. I actually think it's possible that God moved the hearts of some people that loved Israel, just like the text says. They went with him because God had touched their hearts. They loved Israel. And they knew Saul would need some help, and God touched their heart. And they went with him to support him and to be his friends. You know, a job that big would require some help. Pastor Rob mentioned that there was like 100 people at this hoedown last night. That's impossible for one person to pull that off. There were pork smokers and water buyers and, you know, a whole bunch of you got involved in that whole thing. That's just for a hoedown to last one night. Imagine a kingdom being raised up and thousands of people. Takes many hands. But once again, God was providing what and who Saul needed to help the nation flourish. I think one of the things that I've been so impressed with in this study of 1 Samuel is God's provision for our need. God's provision for our need. He gave Saul everything and everyone that he needed to do what God was asking him to do. And he does this for us too. I mean, I think sometimes we want God to do for us what we want to do. We have a goal or an aspiration and we're like, come on, God, why won't you help me here? And I don't think God ever promises to do for you everything that you want him to do. I think some people turn to God because they want God to be their genie. I was rubbing a lamp right there, if you're wondering. I'm, you know, and as I, you know, woo, out comes God, and that sometimes we approach Christianity like that. That Christianity is somehow getting the genie that'll get our agenda done. That's not how it works. When God asks us to do something, He provides what we need to do it, but He may not always give us the thing we want. As I said last week, sometimes he'll drop something in our lap that we weren't seeking. But he also promises to help us with it. Not everybody was happy with God's choice. In verse 27, the rebels said, "How can this man save us?" They despised Saul and they refused to offer any tribute or any gifts. Or in other words, they weren't paying their taxes. I didn't pick him. Not my king. There's just so many parallels. And here's the thing. You know, even God can't keep everybody happy. I mean, you'd think being God, being all-powerful, all-wise, all-knowing, fully sufficient in every way, that God could keep everybody happy. And even God can't keep everybody happy. The people wanted a king, and when God clearly revealed his man, that still wasn't enough to convince some people. I understand why I can't keep everybody happy. I'm a human. And sometimes I'm such a slug. A schmuck. You know, whatever word you want. I get it. Like, if you're unhappy with me, join the club. I mean, seriously, I just a person. And it still hurts when I find out that people are unhappy with me. And you probably feel the same when people are unhappy with you. I mean, if you don't care about what anybody thinks about you, you don't have any friends. I mean, you really, you know, it hurts when people don't like us or when they're unhappy with us. But we should all take some comfort in this, that even God can't make everybody happy. There will always be somebody against something until heaven. I was meditating on that this week. I thought, what is it going to be like to be with millions and millions of people and not have anybody complaining about anything and everybody happy with everything? It's going to be like drugs or something. I mean, like, this is just going to be bliss, right? I mean, we're going to be walking around like, have you heard anybody complain in the last 1,000 years? No. And everybody's happy about everything? Yeah. I mean, really, isn't it going to be just, I'm going to jump over a star. I will. It's hard to comprehend, honestly. Now, in verse 27, what's interesting to me is how Saul responded to these people who didn't like him. It says he held his peace. Literally, in the Hebrew, it means it was as if he was deaf. It was if he was deaf. In other words, he didn't listen to it. And again, we could view that as disinterest and with a touch of arrogance, you know, that Saul just didn't care what anybody thought. I mean, he was tall, dark, and handsome, and he didn't give a rip what anybody thought. Or we could view this as a good way to respond to criticism that is unfounded. I didn't even hear it. Now, when we're criticized and there's merit to the criticism, that ought to be heard and responded to. But when there's criticism without merit, it should go in one ear and out the other as if it wasn't heard at all. If we know we have God's smile, what other smile do we really need? Now, we'll see it in the next chapter that even when Saul had a chance to silence these rebels once and for all, he didn't do it. And I think at this point, it really seems, and I think we can conclude that his heart was really right in this situation. Well, to wrap up, we could say that God lost the election in that particular day, as I said earlier. And I think he would likely lose the election in November. But that doesn't mean you can't choose him as your Savior and King. We're all looking for someone to save us. And we're all looking for somebody to lead us into life. A permanent salvation and an abundant life is not going to come from a human in or out of political office. What we really long for in the depths of our being is to be saved. And what we really long for in the depths of our being is to find life. And that is only available through the one who loved us and gave himself for us and rose from the dead and ascended to the Father and has promised to come again and receive us unto himself. Jesus Christ is the King we're ultimately looking for, friends. Have you come to him? Have you asked him to save you? Have you enthroned him in your heart? Live by faith and step into his provision. Would you stand with me, please, and let's bow for prayer. Pastor Rob's going to come and lead us. There's a lot there in that text, and there's numerous ways of application. And just take a little time and just listen to what God may have to say to you. Listen to His still small voice. Maybe it's just the reminder that what God calls us to and allows to come into our lives, He'll provide us what we need. Maybe it's the reminder that even though you've been off track someplace in your life, now you're trying to get on track. If the enemy's saying, no, God's not going to help you, don't listen to that lie. Don't listen to that lie. God will help you. When you lean into Him, He leans into you. I don't know what it might be, but if God has spoken to you today, take that to heart. And trust yourself to Him. Walk with Him to the best of your ability as you go throughout this week. Pastor.